This is Jim Taylor on WMJ Radio and WMJ.com. We get a chance to visit with Dr. Dean Alexander. He is a professor of law enforcement and the director of the Homeland Security Research Program at Western Illinois University. He's been down to the Macomb area for about 15 years and has extensively researched and studied terrorism and terrorist organizations both on U.S. soil and abroad. And I know a big topic of conversation over the last couple of weeks has been domestic terrorism. And I guess Dr. Alexander will begin our conversation. Is what happened in Washington, D.C., in the U.S. Capitol back on January 6th, is that a definition of domestic terrorism? Can you elaborate? And by the way, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it's... Again, when you talk about activity on the U.S. Capitol, actually the storming of the Capitol, if people, if individuals there threaten violence or utilized violence in order to achieve a political goal or social goal, economic goal, generally speaking, that's viewed as terrorism. Also, there's an object of trying to intimidate the general population or to intimidate government, to have them change behavior. So if some of the individuals that were there that were violent or threatened violence were doing it for the object of, you know, changing the approval of the state electorals, then that could be deemed as terrorism.
So as you're answering that question, when we talk about these volatile times we're in these issues being so polarized, as you're answering that question, I know people are listening and saying, well, what about Antifa and the Black Lives Matter movement? Because people will say,
right,
on the other side of the spectrum, well,
sure,
is he going to call those groups or is he going to elaborate and say that that's domestic terrorism as well? So I know that's got to be a question,
sure,
you're also getting.
Right. So I think we need to be consistent. Whenever any individual, whether it's here or abroad, threatens violence or the use of violence in order to achieve a political goal, social, economic goal, with the object of, you know, changing the behavior of the general populace or the government, at least as an academic definition, that is viewed as terrorism. So it needs to be, you know, consistent. And again, it's fact specific. So not everyone that's, you know, marching or protesting relative to one ideology or group is involved with terrorism. It's when someone is involved with activity that's coupled with violence or threat of violence. So whether it's, you know, in D.C. or in Portland or whatever major city. And again, it's fact specific. So it's the individual himself or herself, whether they engage in that type of activity.
And the other subject is this extremism now that we're seeing, and it's something that you've been researching and studying as well in your capacity in the last 15 years. What about that?
Well, it's the more things are different, the more they're similar. So individuals that are mesmerized by different ideologies that support the use of threat of violence, it's similar whether it's overseas or here. You have a number of on the margins that may embrace a certain ideology, but again, there's nothing improper to believe X or Y or Z. The concern is when that ideology is combined with the openness to use violence or the threat of violence. Again, it should be consistent, irrespective of any ideology. So that's the concern. The government should not be concerned about people having a certain perspective on a topic. They should be concerned if someone has a perspective and is open to using violence or the threat of violence.
Now, I know even prior to this January 6th event at the U.S. Capitol, you know, when we talk about this subject, you know, I want to, you know, kind of preface our remarks by saying, well, you know, Dean Alexander is just not commenting on this because this happened and all of a sudden he wants to provide some type of reaction to this. You know, and I want to let you tell our listening audience, prior to January 6th, you know, you were published, you had several articles published in a number of different publications. So, I mean, this isn't something you just started to say, hey, I'm going to start talking about this January 6th because of this U.S. Capitol event. You've been doing this long prior to that. So I want you to elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. I first published on terrorism in 1991 in law school, and been focusing on this topic full-time since fall 2005, focusing on different issues from terror finance and ISIS and family terror networks and different aspects of international terrorism. Domestic extremism, domestic terrorism, terrorism and law enforcement, the impact of terrorism on law enforcement. So, yes, indeed, I've been focusing on this topic for a long time. And a principal concern is, you know, when political violence or threat of violence is widespread, or the openness to support violence is widespread and cynicism exists, that potentially there can be fracturing of nation states, of countries, so that you have one ideological group against the other, and within those ideological spectrums, you do have some individuals that may be frustrated to the point that some may embrace violence or the threat of violence, and that can be obviously very detrimental. First, it can be criminal. Secondly, it can be detrimental to stability in a country or a region.
So you say one ideological group against another. How concerned are you moving forward in the United States of America of where we're at now? Because there seems to be this great divide when you talk about ideology.
Right. Well, it's not one. You have different chasms that exist. You have different perspectives, different ideologies. And again, there's nothing wrong with ideologies. The issue is whether some segments within those people that have affinity toward X or Y ideology will be open to utilize violence. Some have suggested that the attack or the incident, however you want to characterize it, that, you know, there is a domestic terrorism definition under federal law and some state laws, but there isn't a formal domestic terrorism statute, although you do have some examples, some 50 federal statutes that have and can be utilized relative to quote-unquote domestic terrorism activities, such as, you know, attacks against federal officers and assassination attempts, et cetera, et cetera, if those, you know, where those arise. Under U.S. law, there's a list of foreign terror organizations, FTO. There are about some 60 groups that are listed. There's no such similar DTO list, domestic terror organization list. So that's one facet. Getting back to your question, I think there's a broad interpretation that the incident on January the 6th, so for some people, you know, on the margins may have been emboldening relative to, yes, some segments of the group. Again, we need to differentiate between those that were just, you know, protesting outside and those that came in, and some had violent intent, and, you know, they're being charged with anything from assaulting federal officer, obstructing law enforcement and official duties, unlawful entry in a restricted building, knowingly entering into a building, possession of destructive devices, destroying property, etc. So differentiating between those that might be charged with criminal acts and then those that were, you know, outside and just protesting. So for some of those individuals that may have been involved with criminal activity, they may have been emboldened saying, hey, we were successful, let's try it again, let's do it somewhere else, etc. For some segments of the population, including some that may have been involved with, you know, protesting outside, they may have been turned off that it sort of got out of hand and didn't perceive that there would be, you know, a storming of the Capitol. And then the general populace, I think the majority of, you could look at some of the polling, the majority of population is not supportive of the use of violence. I was asked a similar question before elsewhere, and the issue was, you know, have you changed the scenario? And in 2016, of course, President Trump won the Electoral College, but had the Capitol incident occurred in 2016, except that the demonstrators and then the people that attacked Capitol were actually, you know, pro-Clinton individuals on, you know, on the margins, how would that be characterized? So we, you know, need to be consistent. So irrespective of ideology, if someone's using violence or threat of violence, we need to be concerned about it. Otherwise, there's just mayhem. You know, if anyone who's unhappy about X or Y uses violence, then we basically have anarchy.
You mentioned the FTO, the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. I think you said 60
right.
some odd organizations on there.
Right.
Now, does, and there's no such thing as a domestic terrorist organization list. I guess I'll ask you, should there be a list?
Right. So there's concern that, so if you look at FTO definition, it's a foreign entity that does terrorist activity or her intent capacity to do so, and is deemed a threat to U.S. national security, homeland security. If you would change that, and the activities are, you know, basically occurring overseas initially with that group, if you would have the same thing here, where it's a group based in the United States that does terrorist activity, intent and capacity to do so, and then and then harms, you know, sort of homeland defense. The concern about the DTO list is issues of, you know, freedom of association, freedom of speech. So under the FTO statute, there's also sort of a pending, there's similar legislation that prohibits anyone who's a member of an FTO to provide material support. That means training, expert advice, safe houses, goods or services, monetary, tangible or intangible. The concern is that it could become highly political, of course, that Administration X would list its quote-unquote groups that it deems, you know, problematic on that DTO list. And so it's possible that, you know, a DTO list may not even stand constitutional muster because there are a number of challenges on the FTO list, including some cases in that regard. What is true, it is useful to, you know, some of these, the FBI, DHS has designated certain activities, extremism that's going on in the United States as a higher levels of threat than others. So it's possible to, you know, focus energies and to designate one type of extremism or another that's problematic. Again, that they all should, but given levels of perceived threat, and then you don't necessarily need a DTO list. There are others, academics and otherwise, that say that there is a big gap and you need a DTO list because you can't be as aggressive. Basically, the difference between a prosecuting for FTO membership is much easier than with providing material support to a terror incident. That's going to details about 18 U.S.C. 2339 A and C. With A and C, the government needs to prove that you purposely provide material support relative to a specific terror act. In contrast with B and D, all it needs to prove is that you knowingly provided material support to an FTO without knowledge that the support you were giving was connected to a terror incident. And then with D, 18 U.S.C. 239D, it's receiving military-type training on behalf of an FTO. So there may be some discussions in the coming months. There may be some elements of the incoming administration may be supportive of doing a DTO list, but it could be some pushback. And given the sort of a volatile, intense political climate, it might be unwise.
So political climate, you mentioned that, but you know, you've been studying this topic for 15 years. So we go back to, you know, 2005, 2006, and we fast forward to 2021. How much has social media, how much has that added to the problem, you think?
Well, the capacity of social media, again, irrespective of ideology, is it provides a platform where content, whether it's factual or infactual, so misinformation, disinformation, or capacity to radicalize, recruit, communicate, do tactics, etc., that's available with a click of a mouse. And increasingly also there are different websites and apps that allow for, you know, dissemination of contact communications that are encrypted. And you may have seen there have been some restrictions on people involved with Twitter besides the president and some other social media like Parler, etc. And according to some law enforcement, on the one hand, it's beneficial. They perceive it as beneficial because it reduces the reach for the masses. The downside is that it's harder to follow specific actors that may be leaning toward using violence. So getting back to the question of social media, whether it's the jihadis, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, they utilized different types of, you know, music videos, different type of propaganda online. And then, you know, whether it's here or abroad, you have disparate actors that are utilizing social media to propagate. So instead of having to interact or recruit someone, you know, in person in a neighboring town, this way, depending on the content, you can reach, you know, hundreds or thousands or many, many more.
All right, so as we wrap up here, speaking with Dr. Dean Alexander, professor of law enforcement and director of the Homeland Security Research Program at Western Illinois University in Macomb, how do we bring extremism or domestic terrorism, how do you think we get that or bring that under control?
I think it's, there are many issues. Some have addressed it, that it's not extremism of various ilks. Is a whole of society issue. So you need to have civic community. You need educators. You need religious institutions. You have, other nonprofits, etc. Need to engage. There are people that are obviously, you know, frustrated or on the margins, but there needs to be an emphasis to try to create sort of a center or have a recognition that in the end, you know, utilizing violence will not be productive, and not to insult people's perspective on X, Y, and Z. You know, to hear them out, share perhaps different perspectives, and then, you know, come to the conclusion, okay, we may disagree about different issues, but ultimately, you know, we're all Americans, we're living here together. In order to have tranquility, you know, we can't utilize violence. And if people are opposed to, you know, political developments, then they can become active in their party or a new party. You know, raise funds, become active, raise issues that they deem to be unfair, etc. But ultimately, the only way to have sort of civility is to you know, denounce violence and not to support that. I think that that's the approach. Now, having said that, as we saw with some other extremists, there may be some that have, you know, been radicalized and recruited, that are mobilized. Basically, they support the use of violence and are open to doing that. So in those cases, again, sometimes, you know, law enforcement can speak with them, the FBI, and can get them off their mark. Families can get involved sometimes. Or in some cases, government will utilize undercover agents and informants. Or, you know, if individuals have broken the law, and whether it's terrorism-related or extremism-related or otherwise, then those actions can be pursued. But I think the takeaway is the majority of the populace, I think, is here in the U.S. is not supportive of violence. And I think that's, you know, that's a positive note. And those that are, hopefully their minds can be changed. And, you know, if not, then, you know, then there are other remedies that the government can pursue, you know, assuming people have violated the law.
I appreciate the time from Dr. Dean Alexander, again, professor of law enforcement and director of the Homeland Security Research Program at Western Illinois University. He joins us on WRMJ and WRMJ.com.